Welcome to a special episode of Warships Pod. And in this one, we are considering the state of the US Navy and other aspects of the world's mightiest fleet. And I'm joined by two long-time and highly valued contributors to Warships IFR magazine and also key players in the Guide to the US Navy 2023, our special edition, our special publication. And they are Dr. Robert Farley, who currently teaches at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce. And in addition to that, writes extensively about an array of defence issues. They include air power, sea power, and military innovation. He is a senior editor of Lawyers, Guns and Money, and manager of the LGM podcast. Our other special guest is David Axe, a journalist, author, and filmmaker based in South Carolina. He writes for Forbes, The Daily Beast, and Rolling Stone. And his most recent book is Drone War, Vietnam. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Guide to the US Navy special edition of Warships Pod.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I thought what we could do to start off with is a fairly simple question, though I guess there'll be some complex answers or some fine detail we can drill down into. And that is, in general, the state of the US Navy today. And if I could start off with David, perhaps you can give me a summary of how you see the US Navy as it stands.
Sure. I think the US Navy, after a couple decades of foundering, is now in trouble. The bill has come due for nearly a generation of bad planning, bad strategy, underinvestment, or more accurately, lopsided investment in the wrong things at the wrong times. Incoherence. The Navy should be laser focused on deterring China, deterring the Chinese fleet, and in the event of war in the Western Pacific, defeating the Chinese fleet. And I do not think that the U.S. Navy today is ready to can reliably deter the Chinese, and in wartime can defeat them with reasonable cost.
Rob, what do you think to that?
I mean, I think that David is absolutely right. I think that over the past 20, even 25 years, the U.S. Navy has been chasing relevance in a U.S. national security strategy that has focused on things that aren't really about the Navy, right? And that's, you know, primarily war on terror type stuff. And the U.S. Navy's been making procurement decisions built around that. And the unfortunate thing is that even within the sort of mistaken confines of that pursuit, the Navy has largely failed, right? It would be one thing if the littoral combat ship was, you know, an effective platform that worked. It was just for the wrong mission. Unfortunately, it turns out to have been for the wrong mission, and it doesn't work. And the same thing could be said of the Zumwalt class destroyer. More optimistic about some of the other platforms, but yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I would go so far in terms of agreement with David to the point where I would say that the U.S. Navy no longer has the capacity to deter or defeat China. I think that's open to question. But the fact that it's open to question is a colossal failure of U.S. Navy planning for the last three decades.
So in terms of the incoherence and lack of focus, what is the key thing that has driven that to where we are today, do you think? David?
Right off the top of my head, there are several things the U.S. Navy needs to deter and defeat the Chinese fleet. Reliable, affordable, blue water surface combatants with large magazines capable of long-range fires, plugged into a data network that's robust and far-reaching. That's one. Another is a good submarines in the right mass, capable of sustained frontline patrols, again, in adequate mass with acoustic superiority and torpedo superiority. Also, carrier aviation, again, in adequate mass, with aircraft with sufficient range and access to munitions in adequate quantities to shoulder the main burden of an air war over the Western Pacific, and to do it while to conduct offensive operations while also protecting its own projection platforms. So these are the three things. Basically, you can separate them into domains: air, surface, and undersea. These are the three domains the U.S. fleet must dominate in order to defeat the Chinese fleet. And I think in every single one of those domains, there are vexing problems decades in the making.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what you say there, because I was thinking as you were outlining that, that mass and the ability to hit an enemy repeatedly and destroy them is something that is not just an affliction for the US Navy. And if you talk to people within the defense machinery, within the bureaucracy, they'll say that mass doesn't matter. And they'll actually highlight things with, let's say, the Royal Navy that aren't actually directly germane to the act of taking on an enemy, destroying an enemy, having the mass and a firepower to defeat them. Do you think it's a global thing that people have forgotten what navies are for, which is to fight and to destroy the enemy, to protect their own societies and their own nations? What do you think to that, Rob?
I think that there's certainly something to that, right? And the analogy that I would make, this is not original to me, but a lot of folks have made this analogy before, you know, between the PLA and People's Liberation Army Navy and the U.S. Navy is akin to the Royal Navy and the German fleet before World War One. I mean, you have a much more symmetrical kind of buildup between those two than you have between the Americans and the Chinese. But you have the same sort of thinking about a Navy as, you know, a policy tool that's supposed to fill a bunch of different objectives, right? And so if you go back to the 1990s and you read the doctrinal publications coming out of the Navy, they are all about relevance, right? And some of that builds on stuff that happened in the 1980s when, you know, there was a recognition that the U.S. Navy was simply vastly superior to its Soviet counterpart, so it could do a lot of other stuff. But, you know, from the 1990s and into the 2000s, there's this lack of an ability to sell either to the general public or to the political elite that, you know, the Navy needs to plan to defeat another Navy in battle, right? Which is a problem in a lot of ways that the U.S. Navy hadn't even really had to deal with since 1944. And so, yeah, I mean, I think in the U.S. context, but then also in the European context, there was this lack of recognition. There's other stuff, right? Shipbuilding has deteriorated across the West, military shipbuilding in the United States and other places. But I think the biggest part is people just not understanding that you might once again have naval battles, and those naval battles would require everything that David said, and as you both say, mass, right? It requires actual ships and actual missiles.
Yeah, and David, you've written about the littoral combat ship several times for Warships IFR and other publications, and of course, also about this whole vexed issue of the future of the amphibious vessels as well. So to give us some insight, to give listeners to this episode some insight into those two issues, how is it that a Navy could build so many vessels like the littoral combat ship and keep on going, even though they're getting rid of some? Can you explain a little bit about that whole issue for us?
Sure. I mean, it would take a book. It would take a tome to fully explain it.
The concise version.
That'd be This crisis in small service combatants has its roots in the 1990s. So the littoral combat ship was supposed to be a small, heavily armed, networked, affordable networked combatant that would be the main node in a far-reaching ship missile sensors network, a battle force network, or I can't remember exactly what the eggheads called it. But the original thinking in the 90s was build a lot of these small ships cheaply and load them up with weapons and sensors and plug them into a network. That way, if you lose some of these ships, you're not losing a lot of people, you're not losing a lot of money, and you've got enough additional ships to, you know, to keep the network intact and working. So that was the idea. Whether that idea is appropriate for the Navy's main mission as we see it today, that is deterring and defeating the Chinese fleet, that's a separate question. But the Navy completely failed to execute that original vision for what the littoral combat ship should be. And I should point out also that the idea was that these littoral combat ships, as their name implies, would spend most of their time in coastal waters in the littorals. Anyhow, so as typically happened across U.S. Department of Defense procurement for a long time, and may still be happening, something that was supposed to be small and cheap ended up becoming big and expensive. So the littoral combat ship went from being, say, a 1,000-ton displacement vessel costing less than $1 billion or sorry, less than, let's say it's a couple $100 million, I believe was the target procurement cost. It inflated into a 3,000 ton vessel, each one of which costs several hundred. I think the cost now is $600 or $700 million per ship. Worse, these vessels tried to thread an impossible needle with fairly large displacement and a wide range of missions, everything from anti-submarine warfare to mine warfare to surface warfare, really everything except anti-aircraft warfare. To do all that, to, you know, pack some fairly sophisticated sensors and networking equipment, drone helicopters, things like that, but to do it with a tiny crew, which has some pretty serious implications for maintenance and damage control and, you know, sustainability on a long combat patrol. So to do it with a small crew, the vessels are supposed to be modular. You could swap in different kits, different collections of sensors and weapons and drones for different missions. That never really worked out. Some of the modules, just the Navy couldn't complete them, at least not on time or on cost. Where else do I? So the ships also were weirdly supposed to be fast, and I've never quite understood that requirement. But the speed requirement, something approaching 40 knots, dictated a fairly complex propulsion system, but also resulted in very low fuel efficiency. So here's what we end up with after 20 years, 15 plus years of development, a very large, small ship, with a supposed to have modular weapon systems, but instead is being hardwired each ship for one particular mission. A crew that's too small, very poor endurance, an unreliable propulsion system, and on top of everything, the baseline weaponry in a given hull is fairly modest. Some of the modules would include additional weaponry, but a littoral combat ship sailing today normally will pack, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, it's a 57-millimeter gun.
That sounds right to me. I'm not 100%, but that sounds right.
A couple 30-millimeter cannons for close-in defense, maybe some Hellfire missiles for striking small boats. A few of them have a cluster of four or eight, I can't remember the exact number, of naval strike missiles that have over-the-horizon anti-ship capability. But the magazines are shallow, and there's no long-range or even medium-range anti-aircraft defense. I think the only anti-aircraft defense is a single rolling airframe missile launcher for self-defense. So a littoral combat ship might be able to defend itself. It certainly cannot defend any other vessels around it. So it lacks both defensive and offensive firepower. So now it's worth asking what these ships are for. And even if they worked, which they don't, the propulsion problems have sidelined a bunch of them. And so even if they worked, what are they for, and how are they useful for what the Navy needs to do today? Fight the Chinese in the Western Pacific? And the answer is, they're probably not. The Navy's managed, so it's actually two classes of vessels, even to make this even more complex. Littoral combat ship is not one class, it's two. The Freedom class and the Independence class are very different designs with somewhat similar combat systems. And one of them works okay, the other one doesn't work at all. So the Independences, which are trimarans, are reasonably reliable. The Freedoms, which are monohulls, are not at all. So the Navy has built somewhere around 30 of these ships, and it's already after just a few years of frontline service, decommissioning many of them, especially the Freedoms, which again have these propulsion problems. That's going to leave, at best, you know, a dozen, 15 of the Independences on the West Coast, a few of them armed with over-the-horizon anti-ship missiles, to play some role in a Western Pacific war plan. Exactly what that is, I don't even think the Navy knows for sure.
So just for our listeners, anything we touch on here where we're bound to sound a little bit vague because we can't remember everything, is actually in the guide to the US Navy. Just get a plug in there for it. So if anybody wants to drill down into the detail things, they can find it there. But looking at the US Navy trying to get itself out of that mess, it's decided that it should have a new class of frigates, the Constellation class. And so, Rob, I mean, do you think that will solve the gap, you know, plug the gap, solve the problem that they have?
I think that the Constellations are an indication that they understand the problem. And that's kind of a big deal. You know, I think arguably the Constellations are going to be a little bit over-capable and oversized for the missions that that have been anticipated for them. But there's definitely an understanding that the retirements of lots and lots of ships in the 1990s, their replacement essentially by Arleigh Burke hulls, which really big destroyer/cruiser ship, and the failure of the LCS to really manifest and to be able to perform a lot of the roles that the Navy wanted. And I you know, one thing I want to make a point here is that, you know, well, David is right that the number one mission of the United States Navy is the defeat of the plan in the Western Pacific. But it's not the only mission of the U.S. Navy, right? Every Navy, every major hegemonic Navy, of course, has various sea patrol, sea management, maritime domain management issues that it has to handle. And, you know, there was optimism that the LCS would have all of these characteristics which would let it do that, when in fact what you really could have done is something closer to a Coast Guard cutter that would have allowed you to have presence, and it would have allowed you to do maritime interdiction, would have allowed you to do anti-piracy, right, all this other stuff, without really bothering with the high-intensity combat capabilities that the LCS doesn't even really have. But yeah, no, I think, you know, there is a great deal more modesty with respect to the design of the Constellations. And I think this, I would say that probably this is not just a Navy development within the U.S. military or the U.S. defense industrial base, that you sort of increasingly have an understanding on the air side too, that it's better perhaps to be a little bit more modest in terms of what we're demanding. So, you know, the Constellation is probably a step in the right direction, but, you know, I think a lot of the proof is going to be in the pudding with respect to sort of whether the Constellations are able to come in, what kind of problems that they have, you know, where they fall in terms of cost overruns, and then how many we're going to need to sort of really tip the needle in carrier battle groups and in other like expeditionary battle groups that can be deployed to the Western Pacific.
Right. And I mean, something which touches upon the littoral combat ships, David, which we've had you write about in Warships High Fire magazine, is the whole amphibious warfare side of it, the Gator Navy, as it's called, and what to do with the future of that force. Because I believe the Independence class littoral combat ships, without wasting too much time on those imperfect vessels, they have been proposed to try and give the amphibious forces in the Western Pacific more spread, or to give them something that gives them the ability to spread out the potential for damage. And certainly in recent editions of the magazine, you've highlighted the fact that even though the US Navy may want to reshape the amphibious warship fleet, it's being stymied not just with those vessels, but also, I guess, with the cruisers as well of the US Navy by lawmakers who say you can't get rid of these old ships and invest in new vessels because we want you to keep them. So, I mean, how is the Gator Navy, and how does that whole push and pull between the lawmakers and what the US Navy wants come into it with both the amphibious vessels and also the cruisers as well?
So the Marine Corps, the U.S. Marine Corps, has a requirement for something over 30 large amphibious ships, L-class vessels, they call them, sort of armored and armed high-capacity landing docks and landing platforms and assault ships in order to execute its war plans for high intensity warfare. That's something to the effect of landing, I think, a brigade force. So, and, you know, landing and supporting a brigade force. So, 30 vessels. And the Navy has never, well, not never, but it's been many, many years since the Navy has met the Marine Corps' requirement for L-class ships. The Navy has sort of tinkered around the edges of that requirement by building and experimenting with some interesting auxiliary ships like the mobile landing platforms. I think they call them expeditionary sea bases now, which are converted tankers that, while thin-skinned and pretty much entirely unarmed, can have big flight decks and can carry landing craft and hundreds of people. So the Navy's tinkered around the edges of that requirement with interesting auxiliaries. And yes, has paid lip service to the idea of putting a Marine Corps company, you know, say a couple hundred men at most, men and women at most, actually it would be far fewer than that probably in practice. I don't see how you could pack an entire company on a littoral combat ship, but let's say a company minus of Marines on an Independence class LCS, and those Marines riding in rigid hull inflatable boats carried by the LCS could perform raiding missions or reconnaissance or something like that. There's not, the LCS doesn't have the capacity to support. You'd have to concentrate all of them to make a dent in the requirement to land a brigade. So these auxiliaries are interesting for experimentation and could play useful niche roles in an actual war, but to execute the Marines' war plans, you still need those nearly three dozen big amphibious vessels, which the Navy has not been building in adequate numbers. The deficit is going to get worse because the Navy has underfunded maintenance on some of the older Whidbey Island class landing platforms and our landing docks, and those ships are in extremely poor repair. And that's something like 7 or 8, 9 vessels, you know, a quarter of the L-class fleet. So very few of them are deployable. In reality, on paper, the Navy has nearly 30 L-class vessels. In reality, it can deploy, 25, 26 of them at a time. Well, not even at a time. In theory, could deploy them. The ones in deep maintenance, you really can't count on them for an emergency at all. Okay, so there's a deficit in amphibious ships. You either meet that requirement in order to execute the Marine Corps' war plans, or you change the war plans, right? So, and the Navy and the Marine Corps have been collaborating on a new scheme of operations for Marine Corps forces in the Western Pacific. It's called Expeditionary Advanced Base Operations, EABO. The idea would be, rather than conducting traditional massed beach landing, you know, battalions or a brigade storming ashore to capture a beachhead for follow-on forces, a mission that in an area denial context is extremely risky. When the Chinese have a lot of submarines and anti-ship missiles and bombers firing cruise missiles, It's dangerous to concentrate your amphibious ships in within range of all those weapons. Okay, so in that context, the Navy and the Marine Corps are trying to rethink how the Marine Corps operates in the Western Pacific. So the new idea is that the Marines break up their existing brigades into smaller landing forces, battalion or company size landing forces, and spread them out across a much wider area. Rather than concentrating them for one big beach landing, you spread them out across a dozen smaller landings, and you seize little islands or parts of islands for these sort of rough, small expeditionary bases that might be within, sort of behind enemy lines, so to speak. And from these little bases, you operate drones, you operate anti-ship missiles, you operate rockets, you can use them to refuel F-35 jump jets, you can fly in tilt rotors and you know, load them up with raiders or refuel them there. So these little bases could form little like an ecosystem of lily pads supporting sensors and fires and aircraft in order to build a sensor munitions network that sort of intrudes on enemy-controlled seas and helps to cue and protect Navy surface vessels while also threatening enemy surface vessels. And so this is an interesting scheme. The Marine Corps seems to be all aboard for EABO, but it hasn't backed. The Marine Corps hasn't backed down on its requirement for I think it's 33 L class vessels. And I think the Marine Corps' rationale is that it's great to propose establishing all these small bases, but you still need to get the you still need to land the Marines, and you still need to support them, to resupply them. You still need ships to do it. And you may still, even if you're conducting these expeditionary base operations, you may still need to mass forces for a much bigger beach landing. So the new EABO way of thinking may not totally replace traditional amphibious operations. It may just complement them. So the Marine Corps has not backed away from its requirement for more than 30 large amphibious ships, even as it embraces this this new way of operating that the Navy seems to believe could allow the Marine Corps to adjust its requirements for large ships. So we're at a kind of philosophical impasse that's having some pretty profound effects on what the Navy buys and operates as far as amphibious ships go. And it's been very confusing. It's not getting any less confusing. And the result, the risk, is that the Marine Corps is going to hang its future on a scheme of operations that it cannot execute because it lacks the ships to do so. There's a lot of variables here. The Navy is getting close to pulling the trigger on a new acquisition program for a what could be a large class of what amount to modern LSTs, landing ship tanks, stern ramp landing vessels that each could carry, 75, 100 Marines and a few tanks. Well, not tanks anymore. The Marine Corps doesn't have tanks anymore. Armored vehicles. And the idea being these vessels would be discreet and would easily hide inside civilian shipping lanes, but also that they'd be small enough and cheap enough that you could buy them in large numbers and spread them out across the Western Pacific to support all of these little lily pad bases. And I think the Marine Corps wants these vessels, but I don't think the Marine Corps wants them to replace many or any of the traditional large L-class ships. Stop me if this is too much.
It gets worse, is what
I like. It gets worse. So at the same time, the Navy has been, and the Marine Corps have been also collaborating on a new way of using its biggest L-class ships, the America and Wasp-class assault ships, as light aircraft carriers, basically taking the helicopters and tilt rotors off the ships and replacing them with a large contingent of F-35B jump jets. So a Wasp or an America can support more than 20 F-35s, where routinely they only handle 4 or 5. So you can transform these assault ships into aircraft carriers, and they don't have the capacity or capability of a of a supercarrier, of a Navy supercarrier with, you know, with a 75 plane air wing that has all the different capabilities that is incumbent in that. But it's useful, and the Marine Corps does have, or the Navy does have, 9 of these vessels. Had 10 until recently. One burned down to the waterline, nearly in San Diego a year or two ago. So anyway, the Navy has 9 of these vessels, and they could play an interesting role, sort of as complementary carriers to back up the 10, 11, or 12 supercarriers the Navy's probably going to have over the next 20 years. Okay, great. So, but if you've taken an assault ship out of the rotation, amphibious ready group rotation in order to use it as a light carrier, then you're actually making the L-class deficit bigger. I mean, it's not that these ships can't swing between roles. They can. But you might need to pull a Wasp back to port to load up the forces necessary to, you know, convert it from a light carrier back into an assault ship. So it's difficult for one of these assault ships to do both things at the same time. The Navy, with its experimentation, is actually risking making the amphibious problem worse. It might be better to, if you want light carriers, to buy light carriers rather than load up your assault ships with a second mission. And the list of problems under the rubric of amphibious warfare goes on and on and on. I mean, the Navy bought all these interesting auxiliaries to experiment with ways that these ships could complement the L-class vessels, but now it's proposing to get rid of a bunch of them after only a few years of service. It's a real mess in the amphibious side of things, and what's really lacking is planning clarity. Is the Navy and Marine Corps agreeing on what the Marine Corps is for, and how it should do it, and then, you know, buying the ships to do that? You have to start with planning, strategic. What's the word I'm looking? Conceptual is the word I'm looking for.
Deciding what you want to do with them. Is that what you're saying? Deciding what you want to do with them.
Decide what you want to do with them. Yes, and it with that clarity, the Navy is poised to fix this problem. Just a few years ago, the Navy designed a cheaper version of its main landing vessel, but not the America class assault ships, rather the smaller San Antonio class landing docks. And this is a good ship. It's big. It's well armed in terms of, you know, self defense. Lots of capacity. Big flight deck. It's a good modern ship, and it's cheaper actually than the earlier San Antonio's. So the original plan was to buy a dozen or more of these to keep the amphibious fleet near the Marine Corps' requirement. But the Navy's now signaling that it wants to cease acquiring these vessels in order to do what, we don't know. But that signal is that would precipitate a steep and rapid decline in the size of the L-class fleet. So this problem could get way, way worse if the Navy doesn't keep buying these new landing ships.
And that's a fascinating insight into the dilemmas of the world's most powerful Navy as it tries to grapple with lots of big problems. And Rob, do you think that the Chinese, because we've talked about the Chinese as the opponents here, serious opponents, do you think the Chinese have similar problems? Do they watch the American Navy and how it's evolving? And do they try and second guess the US Navy and the way it will go? And do they have their own problems, do you think, in trying to meet the objectives of what the government wants?
Well, you know, I don't doubt that maybe we need another podcast for the guide to the People's Liberation Army Navy. But, I don't doubt that the Chinese have a whole variety of different problems associated with their force structure, associated with innovation, with what they're doing with their ships. It's just that they're a lot less transparent about those problems. But that said, there seems to have been more, a greater degree of strategic clarity with the Chinese, right? I mean, they are building up a fleet to accomplish a variety of things, right? It's not just to seize Taiwan. It's not just to project power into the Western Pacific. It's also to do a variety of other things. And, you know, for a while, you know, just getting bigger is a way to solve those problems, right? And the Chinese seem fine with the just getting bigger aspect, that you know, mass has a quality all of its own, and that the more ships you build, the more you're going to be able to deploy into the Indian Ocean, into the Eastern Pacific, but you're also going to be able to at least potentially win battles in the Western Pacific around Taiwan. You know, I don't know, and I'm sure that David has a view on this, but I don't know that you would think of the acquisition of the PLAN, at least in terms of hulls, as being directed specifically around defeating the U.S. Navy. I think in some ways, you know, they are looking like a force that you know, wants to have many of the same capabilities as the U.S. in, but not necessarily one that's designed around simply sort of neutralizing or defeating the U.S. in, right? So I don't think that they would concentrate nearly as much attention on large surface vessels like their destroyers. I don't know that they would concentrate as much on their aircraft carrier program or their own big amphib program, right? Because they have counterparts to the big L ships, like the big flat deck amphibs. They have counterparts to the San Antonio class amphibs. And so, if it were this single-minded desire to defeat the U.S. Navy, to defeat or deter the U.S. Navy in the Western Pacific so that they could seize Taiwan, I think their force structure would look a lot different. But, you know, the fact that they're building lots of hulls and they're putting lots of hulls in the water means that they can think of accomplishing those missions, which are, you know, really core to the Chinese interests, while at the same time building out a navy that can be a, you know, a world-class navy operating in parts of the world where Chinese ships have not typically operated. And it's not just, you know, for that, it's not just, for both of those missions, it's not just procurement at this point, right? There's also lots of practice and there's integration. There's integration between Chinese air and naval forces, between Chinese air, naval, and missile forces. But they also do a lot of practice, and they're increasingly sending ships farther abroad to gain experience in terms of long-distance deployments in the South Pacific, in the North Pacific, and in the Indian Ocean. So I think they're trying to do a lot of things right now, the defeat of the U.S. Navy only being one of those.
Right. And, I mean, David, you could give us your thoughts on the Chinese as well in a second, but I'd like to go from that to also looking at the Russian bear, you know, squatting in the corner, the Ukrainian war corner. And because obviously in Europe, there's a lot of worry about what the Russians are up to. But in terms of how the USA sees it, although it's supporting Ukraine in its struggle against Putin's Russia, in terms of the US Navy and how it deals with it, how it copes with it as well, how much of a task is that? How much does the US Navy think really about the Russian threat? I know the Second Fleet, as we have an interview with the boss of the Second Fleet, the New Atlantic Fleet, as it were, for the US Navy has been reestablished. So there's more of an emphasis. But David, if you could start us off on this with just a quick reflection on China and then look at what Russia means to the US Navy as well.
Sure. I'll just say this about China, which is that the Chinese Navy is, in terms of sheer number of hulls, the biggest in the world, with something over 350 combat ships, which is 50 more than the United States Navy possesses. Many of these ships are smaller. All of them are newer, generally. I mean, on average, I mean, each different category of vessel, on average, that category is newer than the American equivalent. This is a big new fleet with a lot of the same capabilities in terms of long-range fires and sensors and data networks that the U.S. Navy possesses. So technologically, it's kind of a wash. And in terms of tonnage, the Chinese fleet is catching up fast to the U.S. fleet. But the big factor that would be decisive in a naval war in the Western Pacific is simply the geography of the potential battlefield. The Chinese fleet operates miles from its own coast and has a shipyard infrastructure within easy reach of everywhere it wants to deploy to win the war that matters most, which is, you know, the war over Taiwan, the coming war over Taiwan. The U.S. fleet divides its forces 60-40 between the Pacific and the Atlantic, and those forces are operate from a much thinner and less robust shipyard infrastructure, port infrastructure, that is thousands of miles from where these two navies would fight. The geography is brutal and unforgiving for the U.S. Navy, and massively favors what China wants to do and the capabilities it has built to achieve that. So the U.S. fleet should be a lot... Let me be clear. The U.S. Pacific fleet should be bigger than the Chinese fleet in order to reliably deter it and in wartime defeat it because of that tyranny of distance. Instead, it is smaller and older, and those gaps are only going to grow in the coming years. So it's pretty dire as far as China goes. The problem is, or as far as the Russian problem goes, I think that problem is settled. I think that a handful of Ukrainian drone operators and any ship missile crews have beclowned the Russian Navy. There was some debate in naval circles prior to Russia's wider war on Ukraine over the state of the Russian fleet. It was a fleet that on paper was pretty big, but all of its large surface combatants were leftovers from the Soviet Union. The only new combatants it was building were small corvettes, and there was some pretty serious limitations on the number of engines that the Russian Navy could buy that put a cap on how many corvettes it could build every year. Sure, these caliber missiles are pretty impressive, and more of Russia's smaller combatants are now compatible with that missile. So there was, you know, some debate, but I think that this year has settled that debate. The Russian fleet is not a major threat to the United States. I think NATO navies minus the United States can handle that threat. The U.S. fleet should be more focused on the Western Pacific and shifting more of its forces to the Pacific, rather than adding to NATO's margin over Russia in the Atlantic.
But that would depend in terms of NATO being able to handle the Russians without or just with minimal help from the U.S. Navy on people like, you know, forces rather like the Royal Navy or the German Navy or whatever, not splitting themselves and sending key units to the Indian Ocean and the Western Pacific, where they're not really needed. They're not going to be in the same league as the U.S. Navy versus the People's Liberation Army Navy of China. So do you think, and Rob maybe could reflect on this first, that actually NATO navies, the European NATO navies, should just stop this idea of having their own Pacific tilt, and they should just focus on containing the residual Russian threat?
So, you know, I think that deployments by European navies to the Pacific have generally speaking, been primarily about demonstrating solidarity, right, and demonstrating sort of long-range expeditionary capability. And that you're absolutely right, that you can focus most European attention, apart from perhaps the French and the British, most European attention just on the European theater. You know, I want to echo David in talking about how dire the Russian naval situation is, because it's really a significant problem, and it very well could get worse, because I would rate the likelihood that the Russians are going to control Sevastopol by 2023 as probably, but not definitely. And if the Russians lose control of Sevastopol, then that essentially guts Russian naval capabilities in the Mediterranean and really in a large part of the world. And I also don't think that the Russians are going to be able to rebuild their navy, right? I don't think they're going to have the shipbuilding chops. You know, they're done in the Baltic. with Finland and Sweden joining. So really, you know, the main Russian contribution, the main thing that the United States has to worry about with respect to Russia is the strategic ballistic missile submarine force. And the United States, I think, is still going to pay attention to that. But, you know, every other conventional capability that the Russians have is something that that can easily be sort of overmatched by NATO navies. And I think probably overmatched by NATO navies, you know, even with like the French and the British tying behind their back. And so, yeah, I mean, I would sort of echo the argument that, you know, the Navy needs to really start thinking seriously about, you know, additional redistribution forces to the Pacific where the major problem is. You know, I think that this may also have an effect on how the Navy thinks about the Middle East. You know, the Navy would rather not think about the Middle East, but the political demands, you know, continue to draw American military attention and maritime military attention to issues in the Middle East. But yeah, at this point, there is no fleet other than the Chinese fleet that should be regarded as a significant strategic problem for the United States. But it's a really significant strategic problem. And it's one that you know, we literally have not dealt with since 1943. And so that's a significant change in how the U.S. should think about maritime power.
Right. So we've talked about the worrying side of things for the U.S. Navy and in terms of the geopolitics and the tasks that it handles. So, Rob, what about the good side of the picture? What about the position the U.S. Navy is in today and the positive side of it, that it still does hang on to that title of the world's most powerful Navy? Do you think there are things there to be positive about?
It has been the largest Navy in the world since, you know, again, I keep coming back to 1944, but this is a, you know, a major moment. You know, the upsides are that, you know, it continues to be able to operate, and it has extensive experience operating the big carriers. It has extensive experience operating the big amphibs. It has a lot of experience with the major surface units that it has already had. It's thought a lot about how to fight networked warfare, even though a lot of that hasn't been tested. I would add that for the Chinese, there is a risk in the fact that everything is new. You know, the fact that everything is new means that everything's going to grow old at the same time. I mean, that's not as much of a problem for the USN, right? Which has had, you know, which has been producing Arleigh Burke since the 1980s. And the first one is going to be retired probably before the last one is built. And so that means that your maintenance is spread out across those hulls over, you know, a lot of time. Whereas the Chinese, you know, they're going to discover they have some pretty profound maintenance problems coming up when it, you know, it goes from building this giant fleet to making sure that this giant fleet can stay in the water and can operate at distance. But the U.S. Navy can, right? And there's no doubt that the U.S. Navy can operate anywhere it wants in the world and bring significant capabilities to anywhere that it needs to fight at any given time. And it has, you know, this enormous amount of you know, strategic flexibility. You know, I think the other part that we haven't talked about yet, but that probably does need to be talked about, is the replacement of the ballistic missile fleet, which is going to be a massive expense for the USN, but is absolutely necessary to maintaining, you know, a lot of the strategic position of the U.S. Navy, the strategic position the Navy has held. But even there, you may have opportunities, right? And I know there's at least some thinking about doing with the older Ohio-class ballistic missile submarines what we've already done with a few of them, which is turning them into SSGNs. And David might be able to speak a little bit more about that. So, you know, I think that there are still upsides to being the most, you know, the largest and most powerful and most experienced Navy in the world. But the U.S. Navy, you know, faces risk in a way that we haven't faced in living memory.
Brilliant. Thanks for that. That's very good analysis from you. And David, what's your take on that?
Sure. If there's any reason for optimism, it's that the U.S. Navy still possesses at least two classes of warship in key categories that are fundamental to its ability to deter and defeat China in the event of war. The Virginia-class submarines and the Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, between those two platforms, both you know, tried and true and in volume production, between those two classes, the Navy has a solid foundation for undersea and surface warfare between the 30 plus Virginias and more coming, and the nearly 80 Burks that the Navy soon will have, and more of those coming as well. These two platforms are world class, if not the best in their categories in the world. So, good platforms. Neither one of which is new. Both of which are the Burks in particular reaching the limits of their design, their design's growth potential. So both need to be replaced sooner than later with affordable platforms that so that the Navy can continue the same production rate, which is roughly two of each, if not more, per year forever. So these are good platforms. We need to replace them. If we have to go to war soon, it's these two platforms and their crews that will be doing the bulk of bearing the brunt of the fighting. And those classes then are reason for optimism that in the near term, the Navy possesses at least two very good platforms for deterring and winning war. More importantly, however, we talk a lot about ships. A ship is nothing without its crew. A ship is just a hunk of metal. And the Navy, I would still bet on an American sailor before I would a Chinese sailor, for example, or certainly a Russian sailor. The American sailors are well-led, well-trained, well-supported, and that, more than any platform, is a reason for optimism in the near term. Human capital requires constant maintenance and replenishment, of course, and it's expensive, so these are things we need to pay careful attention to. Sailors also require leadership, and I would argue that the Navy's mid-tier leadership, your lieutenants and captains, is good. I would also argue that leadership at the higher level, at the level of an admiral, is not so good. These are the folks who oversee procurement programs, who design the fleet, who make the big decisions about where we assign resources that result often in fiascos like the littoral combat ship. So the Navy's senior leaders need to do a much better job of husbanding resources, allocating resources, and spending money wisely to produce the fleet that these world-class sailors need to deter and win wars. So we can be optimistic in the near term. There's so many long-term challenges based on poor leadership and poor spending decisions that I don't know if it's a wash in the end, and I don't want to find out. I don't want to go to war and find out. So, but of course, that's the argument for a strong fleet to deter that war in the first place. So I don't know, if I had a message for Navy leaders, it would be spend money better.
It's been great to talk to you two about the U.S. Navy, particularly as you are the magazine's main American contributors and have played pivotal roles in both the first edition of the Guide to U.S. Navy in 2019 and the latest edition of the Guide to U.S. Navy, which is called the Guide to U.S. Navy 2023, but of course is already out. And in fact, it's just gone on sale in Canada and North America. But the interesting thing for me personally, as somebody who's grown up interested in naval history and gazed at the colossus that is the U.S. Navy taking over the rule of the seven seas from the Royal Navy, the British Navy, is just how important a force it is globally. Something I appreciate every day when I look at news on the U.S. Navy and its activities and put together an edition of Warship Sci-Fi, the monthly magazine. So I think that really, thank goodness for the U.S. Navy and its global role, despite its challenges in the future and also today, because I think it is the foundation of security for the whole world, really, against what I see as some pretty serious and worrying trends in the rise of authoritarian strong men, or should we say strong regimes, would be strong regimes in the case of Russia, which has shown us in Ukraine how dangerous it is, and China, which is on the rise. And hopefully we will not have a war with China over Taiwan, and we can keep Russia contained without the Ukraine war spreading. And I think the US Navy, as the foremost bulwark of global security, Western security, if you like, but actually global security, is what makes people like Vladimir Putin and the Chinese leadership pause before they do anything, because the one thing they don't want to take on is an American fleet that has the power, the reach and the presence to actually punish them for any transgressions they make against democracies or anyone else, but also keeps them contained. And I think that is the value of the US Navy. And the Guide to the US Navy profiles that mighty force, which is of quite staggering proportions compared to any other navy. And so anyway, many thanks for coming in and discussing the state of the US Navy on the Warships Pod.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having us.
Whatever you want to know about the United States Navy of today, we like to think that it's on offer in the Guide to the US Navy 2023, because it profiles warships themselves, submarines, aircraft, and their statistics, the technical side of what they do, and also their operations and the many missions on behalf of the USA and also NATO that they undertake around the world. So we have a mix of ship profiles, we have a mix of unit profiles looking at the US Marine Corps and also the US Navy aviation arm, and also the elements such as mine warfare and patrol vessels. But in there, there's also commentary and analysis as well. And for example, we have some commentary on the Chinese threat and also Russia's formidable threat, which I think is still considerable myself and needs bearing in mind. And on top of that, we have a look at the role of NATO within US Navy thinking. And there's an interview with the boss of the US Second Fleet, which is a force that has been revived since the Cold War to try and organize the US Navy and Allied Navy's strategy and tactics in coping with a resurgent Russian naval presence in the Atlantic. On top of that, there's some history. There's a look at the early days of the US Navy's nuclear deterrent, and also something about how ballistic missile submarines of the US Navy have gone on to find new roles without being platforms for Trident or Poseidon nuclear missiles. And to conclude the Guide to the US Navy 2023, there's a two-page picture essay on the making of the original Top Gun movie in the late 1980s, which shows how the US Navy was involved in helping out. It's a very short piece of text and some fascinating images from that production. So it's an action-packed publication. I'm sure anybody that buys it will enjoy it. And if you haven't come across it yet, then please visit the Warships website, warshipsifr.com, where there is a list of where you can buy it, certainly in the USA and Canada, and it's also available in other parts of the world, including the UK.